All right, everyone, get ready for a deep dive. We're tackling a case today that throws a real wrench into the gears of free speech. Osborne v. Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all know the First Amendment protects what we say, but what about what you have, what you possess at home, in your own home? That's where things get a little dicey.
Well, you know what's fascinating about Osborne is it forces us to confront this really tricky balancing act. You have, on the one hand, you have this, like, bedrock principle of individual liberty, this freedom to possess things, even if they're offensive, controversial, whatever. But then on the other hand, you have the state and its interest in protecting children, especially from exploitation.
So, like, set the stage for us a little bit. What happened in this case?
Okay, so we're in Ohio, 1990s Ohio. And Clyde Osborne, this is the guy, he's convicted for possessing photographs of minors, content that was, you know, clearly not okay. Now, what makes the case interesting is that Ohio law at the time banned any nude images of minors, like any, no matter the intent, no matter the circumstances surrounding it. So that's where the legal battle really begins.
So it sounds like the Supreme Court wasn't just looking at some photos. They were really struggling with the idea of if the government can actually ban something that you own in your own house.
Yeah.
Even if it's, you know, upsetting to a lot of people. Isn't that kind of like censorship?
Exactly. And to make things even more complicated, you had this precedent from 1969, Stanley v. Georgia. The court had already said possessing obscene adult material that was protected under the First Amendment. So in Osborne, they're asking, is child pornography different enough that it deserves its own category, an exception to this protection of what you can have in your own home?
That's a big question. So the state of Ohio, I'm assuming, they had a pretty strong opinion on all this.
Yeah, they did. The state's argument centered around the need to protect children. Protect children from exploitation. They argued that possession of child pornography, even privately, even in your own home, it fuels the market for this abuse. And that's a harm the state has a right to try to prevent.
Yeah. Yeah, I can see how that'd be a hard argument to just ignore. But as you said, that law, that Ohio law was so broad, didn't it? It potentially criminalize things like even medical textbooks.
Yeah.
Just because they had, you know, drawings of human anatomy. Seems a little over the top.
Right. So that's where the Ohio Supreme Court came in. Instead of throwing out the whole law, which they could have done, they did something, I guess, clever. They narrowed the scope of it. So they said it only applies to images with a lewd exhibition or graphic focus on genitals. And also, this is important, they added this element of scienter. You had to know the content was illegal. So that helped address some of those concerns about the law being way too broad.
Okay, so the state is trying to protect kids. The Ohio Supreme Court, they're trying to make the law make a little more sense and target, you know, only the most egregious things. So where does that leave Mr. Osborne?
Well, the case goes all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And they make a distinction between Osborne and that earlier case, the Stanley case. They uphold Ohio's right to ban child pornography, saying the harm to children outweighs the right of someone to possess it. However, and this is where it gets interesting, they actually overturn Osborne's conviction.
Wait a minute. So they agree with the law, but he still gets to go free. I don't quite follow.
Well, it all comes down to the trial itself. The Supreme Court, they said the jury wasn't instructed properly on those narrower parts, those elements that the Ohio Supreme Court added, the lewd exhibition and scienter parts. Basically, they might have convicted him just because of the nudity alone, which isn't enough under this new law. Even Justice Blackmun, who, you know, he agreed with the majority, he said this, and I quote, "The instruction given did not require the jury to find that the photographs were lewd."
So they're basically saying, yeah, okay, the law's okay, but you can't send someone to jail without proving they met all the specific criteria.
Exactly. Even when we're talking about tough issues like child pornography, you got to follow the legal process. It's about being fair, you know, it's about making sure that any conviction is based on real, solid legal ground.
This case, it feels like this constant push and pull. You have this fundamental right to privacy in your own home, but then this need to protect children.
Hmm.
Did the Supreme Court find that balance? Or did they just kind of create a whole new set of problems?
That question, that takes us beyond Osborne, beyond this one case, and into this larger debate about how we deal with this kind of content. Remember that dissent from Justice Brennan? That's where things get really interesting.
Welcome back. Before the break, we were talking about how in Osborne, the court really tried to find that balance between protecting kids and respecting personal freedom. But not all of the justices were convinced they got it right.
All right. You mentioned Justice Brennan and his dissent. What was he so concerned about? Didn't the court already, like, narrow the law down so it wouldn't be so broad? Yeah, see, Brennan's issue wasn't so much with what the law in Ohio was going after, but more like the effect he thought it could have. He was really worried about this kind of, like, intrusion into people's homes, you know, what they choose to possess in private on their own. He thought it set a dangerous precedent.
So he's saying even if the goal was to protect children, this law could end up, you know, silencing other forms of expression that might be totally fine. I mean, where do we draw the line?
Exactly. For Brennan Stanley v. Georgia, that 1969 case about the obscene material, the adult material, that was the line. The court had said, basically, look, what you have in your own home, that's your business, even if other people don't like it. And Brennan, he didn't really see a good reason to change that thinking just because of Osborne.
Okay, so this goes back to that central tension, this balance between, you know, protecting kids from exploitation, which is huge, and then that right to individual freedom, especially at home.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't sound like Osborne v. Ohio really settled the debate.
No, it really didn't. And here's the other thing, technology. Osborne was in 1990, way before the internet, you know, really blew up. Imagine trying to apply those same ideas from the case to the internet, where stuff is, you know, flying all over the place, nobody knows who's who, and you can change pictures, images so easily, it's just a whole different ballgame.
Wow. Yeah, you're right. It's not just about some photographs in a drawer anymore. It's a totally different world now. Think about those parts the Ohio Supreme Court added, the lewd exhibition and graphic-focused things. How do you even apply those to everything that's online?
Right. It's a huge problem for legal experts. And then you have that whole thing about Signter, like proving someone knew they had illegal stuff online, on the internet. Good luck.
So is Osborne v. Ohio just obsolete then? Is it like, you know, a dinosaur case that can't keep up with the digital world?
Not quite. Well, you know, technology has definitely changed. The core questions from Osborne are still super relevant today. The tension between free speech and protecting children, how do we even define harmful content, balancing law enforcement powers with individual rights. These are all things we are dealing with today, even with social media, with the dark web, with all of it.
So it sounds like Osborne is kind of the beginning of a much bigger conversation.
Totally. It gave us, you know, a framework, a starting point, even a language for talking about these really complicated topics. Now we have to figure out how those ideas work in a world that's so different from 1990s Ohio.
It makes me think of a case we talked about before a while back, Ashcroft v. Free Speech Coalition.
Yeah.
Do you remember that one? It was about virtual child pornography. You know, those computer-generated images, no real children involved.
Oh, right. Yes. In that case, the Supreme Court, they actually struck down the law that tried to ban virtual images. They said it was too broad and could end up criminalizing protected speech like art or even medical imaging, some kinds. It shows how the law is always trying to keep up with technology, always running behind, it seems.
And in Ashcroft, the court realized that even though virtual child pornography, I mean, it's disgusting, but it doesn't harm a child in the same way as a real image of abuse does. That difference, that seems really important. But how do you even make laws about that online? On the internet?
Right, exactly. It's starting to seem like a one-size-fits-all approach just won't work online. We need better laws, better strategies that deal with the harms of child exploitation, but without stepping all over, you know, legitimate ways that people express themselves.
So where do we even start? How do we make sure the law can keep up with technology that's changing so fast?
Well, that's the big question, isn't it? It needs a lot of different things. We need to be able to talk openly about the good and the bad of technology, about the, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We need to bring in experts from law, from tech, from psychology, all sorts of fields. And we need to be ready to look back at old cases like Osborne and see how they might apply to our digital lives today.
Welcome back to the show, everybody. We've been talking about Osborne v. Ohio, this case that, you know, it really makes you think about free speech in our digital world. Every time we think we understand it, tech throws us a curveball.
Yeah, for sure. This case, it was decided back in 1990, and it still has a lot to teach us about the problems we face today. Back then, it was photos, physical photographs, but now it's just this flood of digital stuff everywhere.
And that makes it a whole lot harder to define, you know, to define and regulate child pornography. People are anonymous online. They can change pictures easily. There's just so much content.
You got it. It's almost impossible to control. And all the while, we're trying to find that balance, you know, between protecting children and protecting our freedoms. It's tricky.
So have we done anything about this? Have we tried to update the laws at all?
Oh, yeah, definitely. In recent years, there's been a bunch of new laws, legislation, all aimed at fighting child exploitation online. A lot of it focuses on giving law enforcement more tools, you know, to investigate, to prosecute these crimes, make the penalties tougher, and provide resources to help victims.
But I bet there's been some pushback, especially from those who worry about, you know, about free speech.
Oh, for sure. Some of these new laws, I mean, they have good intentions, but they've raised some concerns. For example, some critics say that if you define child pornography too broadly, you could end up attaching artists, researchers, even people who just have pictures for themselves. No intention to hurt anybody.
It's that same question we've been talking about this whole time. How do we protect kids without giving up basic freedoms?
It's a question that never goes away. We have to remember how harmful child pornography can be, but also protect free speech and make sure the government doesn't have too much power. It's a real balancing act.
So does Osborne v. Ohio, does that case, even though it's from so long ago, does it offer any guidance as we, you know, try to navigate all of this?
Absolutely. I think the principles from that case, the ideas, especially about writing very specific laws and proving intent, you know, proving that someone meant to do something wrong, those are still really important. They give us a way to create laws that work, laws that are constitutional, to deal with child exploitation in our digital world.
Of course, actually putting those ideas into practice, that's a whole other thing.
Oh, totally. But Osborne gives us a good foundation, a solid starting point. It's up to us to take those ideas and figure out how they work in the 21st century, how they work today.
All right, so let's wrap this up. What are the big things our listeners should remember about Osborne v. Ohio and, you know, why it matters today?
Well, I think the most important thing is that child pornography is complicated. It has so many consequences, you know. It's not just about what one person thinks is right or wrong. It's a problem for all of us.
And we can't just ignore the tough questions, right? We have to talk about protecting children, but also protecting free speech and making sure the laws are actually fair.
Exactly. Technology is changing so fast, constantly, so we have to adapt our laws, how we understand this issue, to keep up with the changes. It's a constant process, really.
Well, this deep dive into Osborne v. Ohio has been really interesting. It's a case that makes us face some hard truths, and it makes us think about the law, about ethics, about some really tough choices.
Yeah, I agree. But it also shows that there's hope. If we're open and honest, if we learn from past cases, if we're willing to try new things, I think we can create a world that's safe for kids, but also respects our freedoms.
That's a great way to put it. And on that note, we'll wrap up this episode of The Deep Dive. Thanks for listening, everyone. Until next time, keep thinking, keep learning, and keep working towards a better future.